So we're reading from Canto 7, Chapter 9, Text 34. So I thought I'd begin with a quick reminder of exactly where we're at in the Bhagavatam, just so that everyone can remember and put this all into context. So obviously we're in the pastime of Lord Nrsingadev and his saving his great devotee Prahlad Maharaj from the clutches of Hiranyakashipu, his demon father. So Canto 7 begins with a conversation between Shukadev Goswami and Maharaj Parikshit. Canto 6 is a description of many demons and demigods fighting. So we have the pastime of Vritrasura, who is a demon essentially, although in true nature he's a devotee of the Lord, but he's a demon. And the Lord Vishnu advises the demigods on how to kill Vritrasura. Approach Tadichi and he will help. The churning of the milk ocean is demigods versus demons. And of course Lord Vishnu appears as Mohini Murti to aid the demigods. And of course we have the killing of Hiranyaksha, which Hiranyakashipu is very upset about. So many situations where Lord Vishnu has been on the side of the demigods and the demons have been defeated through the aiding of Lord Vishnu. So Maharaj Parikshit has a question for Shukadev Goswami. He asks him, why? Why is Lord Vishnu helping the demigods? Is he partial? Because of course in the Bhagavad Gita we understand that Krishna explains Samoham Sarvabhuteshu. Lord Krishna is equal to everyone. So why is he helping the demigods on so many occasions? So in answer, Shukadev Goswami quotes a conversation between Maharaj Yudhishthir and, anyone remember? Narad Muni. So Maharaj Yudhishthir and Narad Muni have a very interesting conversation, and this conversation runs throughout Canto 7. So where we're at is a continuation of a description of a conversation between Yudhishthir Maharaj and Narad Muni. And they're discussing. So Narad Muni is instructing Yudhishthir Maharaj on the pastime between Krishna and Shishupal. And so within this pastime, Narad Muni mentions Jay and Vijay, because the origin of Shishupal and Dantavakra is Jay and Vijay. So then he briefly explains Ravana and Kumkarn. He mentions Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha. And then he also mentions, of course, Shishupal and Dantavakra. And so Yudhishthira Maharaj is particularly interested in this pastime between Hiranyakashipu and Prahlad Maharaj. Therefore, the conversation goes in that direction. And so then the following chapters describe the wonderful pastime of Prahlad Maharaj. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada Srila Prabhupada Ki. From the great lotus flower, Brahma has generated, but Brahma certainly could see nothing but the lotus. Therefore, thinking you to be outside, Lord Brahma dove into the water and attempted to find the source of the lotus for 100 years. He could find no trace of you, however, for when a seed fructifies, the original seed cannot be seen. So the purport. This is a description of the cosmic manifestation. The development of the cosmic manifestation is like the fructification of a seed. When cotton is transformed into thread, the cotton is no longer visible. And when the thread is woven into cloth, the thread is no longer visible. Similarly, it is perfectly correct that when the seed that has generated from the navel of Gobardakshay Vishnu became manifested as a cosmic creation, one could no longer understand where the cause of the cosmic manifestation is. Modern scientists have tried to explain the origin of creation by a chunk theory, but no one can explain how such a chunk might have burst. The Vedic literature, however, explains clearly that the total material energy was agitated by the three modes of material nature, because of the glance of the Supreme Lord. In other words, in terms of the trunk theory, the bursting of the trunk was caused by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thus, one must accept the Supreme Cause, Lord Vishnu, as the cause of all causes. Om Jnanatimirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Mukum Kuroti Vachalam Pangum Lingayate Girim Yat Kripat Maham Bande Shri Gurundinatarinam Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. I feel unqualified being on the Vyasa Sun. Prabhupada talks in the first canto about he who is qualified to be on the Vyasa Sun. He mentions purity. He mentions being fixed in devotional service. So unfortunately, I have neither of those. I'm striving. So please give me your blessings that I can say something of some use this morning. We do have a short time, so that's only 20 minutes left. But of course, we're looking here at the prayers of Prahlad Maharaj. A chapter is entitled, Prahlad Maharaj Pacifies the Lord with Prayers. So of course, we've heard in classes over the past few days and weeks that after Nrisimhadev appeared from the pillar in order to kill Hiranyakashipu, actually Nrisimhadev at that point was the most angry. So there's many deities of Nrisimhadev that one can worship. But Ugra Nrisimha, we all know, is the most fearsome deity. And actually it's ill-advised for most people to worship the Ugra Nrisimha deity. But I was with myself and Jankinath Prabhu, were with Janani Vas Prabhu one evening late into the night. And he was describing this pastime of Nrisimhadev. And he was explaining how the point at which Nrisimhadev appeared from the pillar, this particular form of Nrisimhadev is called Shtana, Ugra Nrisimha. Shtana means pillar. And at this point, Nrisimhadev is the most fierce. So this deity of Stana, Ugra Nrisimha, is the most fearsome of all Ugra Nrisimha deities. And it's very, very ill-advised to worship this form of Nrisimhadev. Because at that point, Nrisimhadev was extremely, extremely angry because his dear devotee, Prahlad Maharaj, had been so much victimized by his father. And therefore, he really wanted to kill and sever Hiranyakashipu. And therefore, worshipping this deity is very dangerous. But of course, his purport is referring to the prayers. Well, this verse is one of many prayers which Prahlad Maharaj makes to Hiranyakashipu, to Nrisimhadev. But it's referring to Lord Brahma. And it's referring to a pastime which takes place, which is described in the third canto in the ninth chapter. So Lord Brahma, obviously we understand it's described how he appears from the navel of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. And when he actually appears, he has no idea where he's come from. So he's trying to understand his origins. So just like a baby, when a baby appears from the womb of the mother, it's looking around. And actually also in the third canto, it's described how in the womb, a baby has the darshan. Prabhupada describes that it's only special individuals. But they have the darshan of Lord Narayan. And they're in such a terrible situation, so constrained, very smelly, very hot, blood and many other inauspicious items are in the womb. And the baby is very, very uncomfortable. And it's praying to Lord Narayan that please let me out of here. And when I come out, I will be your devotee. I promise I will be your devotee. But when it comes out, it's confused. It doesn't know what's happening, so it starts crying, Prabhupada describes. And immediately the modes of material nature begin to attack. They begin to attack the baby. And the baby becomes more and more influenced. And eventually, in the general case, especially in these days, the baby, a child, tends towards material nature as opposed to the divine nature. So Lord Brahma comes from the navel of Govardhana Vishnu, and he's confused. He doesn't know what's happening, he doesn't know where he is, and he doesn't know what to do. So Prabhupada describes many names for Lord Brahma. One is Swayambhu, one is Aja. Aja means unborn. So of course Lord Brahma is born, but he's not born in the conventional sense. He has a father but no mother. So naturally, when a father and a mother combine, there is a baby. But in the case of Lord Brahma, he is the source of Kalpadakshaya Vishnu, Lord Vishnu alone. Mother Lakshmi doesn't need to get involved. So in this case, Prabhupada, in one of the purports in this chapter, describes how Lord Krishna doesn't need to... He's not reliant on anything. He's not reliant on anyone else. He has everything within himself, and he simply needs to desire. When he desires, everything takes place. So we sing every morning, Angani yasya sakalendriya vrittimanti, that the Lord's limbs, the Lord's senses can be used to fulfill anything he needs to. So just as an example, at the moment the offering is taking place. The Lord is taking bhoga. So he doesn't need to be, he may be, but he doesn't need to be on the altar, on the tables eating. He can simply eat with his eyes. Simply smelling is equal to eating. So sometimes people ask that you're offering to the Lord, but the plate looks, to our materialized, it looks the same as it was before we offered. But actually the Lord doesn't need to actually physically take the food off of the plate. Simply by seeing, he's eating. There are many other things that we can learn from this pastime of Lord Brahma. First of all, he begins through personal endeavor to understand where he is. So he begins by going through the stem of the lotus and going deep, deep down in trying to observe and study where he is. And this garners very little for him. He Shishirada Gokul Nanda ki, Shishi Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki, Shishi Gornitai ki. So from his personal endeavor, Lord Brahma doesn't work out a great deal as to where exactly he is. He returns to the lotus just as confused as he was. But then he gets an instruction. This instruction is in two syllables, ta ba. He hears a voice which instructs him to engage in tapa or austerity. And so when he actually engages in this tapa, that's when he actually gains some realization. So from this we can also understand that through external endeavor we can gain relatively little. Of course he gained the instruction through his external endeavor. But actually when his endeavor became more of an internal one, it's described how he meditated, engaged in meditation for 100 years. That's when he actually gained the mercy of the Lord, and that's when he actually was given the inspiration through the fifth note of the flute of the Lord. He gained the inspiration to create, and the instruction to create from the Lord. So in our daily activities we have a lot of external endeavor, and this can often become the emphasis. And it's not that one shouldn't engage in external endeavor, but through our efforts we should always remember that through actual internal endeavor is where the mercy actually comes, and that's when we can actually progress in Krishna consciousness on a much deeper level. It reminds me of Sachinandan Raj. He was here a few months ago and he was doing some kirtan. And so at the end of the kirtan, he was just giving his realizations and feelings, and he was talking about becoming a receiver. So he was saying that we're very busy during the day, we're doing many, many things, similar to how we're discussing today. But he said that through really engaging with the holy name, through really going much deeper and really feeling the holy name, we become less of a doer and more of a receiver. and becoming a receiver means that our spiritual life can take a whole different trajectory. Becoming empowered, we talk about becoming empowered. We can become empowered on a managerial level, we can become empowered on an external level. And that's also very important. But real empowerment comes on an internal level. So, also Prabhupada in the purport, he's talking about modern scientists. And he mentioned something very interesting. He mentions the chunk theory. Now, my understanding of this chunk theory is that he's talking about the Big Bang. I'm not sure if it was called the chunk theory in the 1960s. I don't know how the name may have progressed. But the Big Bang is a very interesting idea. Of course, we're all to some degree familiar with this idea, how there was some cosmic energy, however you want to describe it, but some antimatter is how scientists often describe it. And then suddenly there was an explosion. And that explosion continues today, and the universe is expanding continuously from that great force, that great energy. But there are many problems with this theory. It's the best theory that scientists have for creation. But many obvious questions. Where did that antimatter come from in the first place? What caused that explosion? And then we can go into the realms of how did all of this come about? I was reflecting on the complications of this world, or the complexity, more like, of this world. We have Janmashtami going on, and we're preparing for the Janmashtami festival. We have around 70,000 visitors who come through the doors on the 21st and 22nd of August. But it takes so much effort, so much endeavour to create this festival. The tents are going up, the stages are being made, so much boga is being brought in for so much food, there's so much complexity to this festival. And then you think about the complexity of running the country, and then the complexity of running, and the complexity of of the continent and the world around us. And then you go to the solar system and the galaxy, and then the universe that we're in, and then the many universes which are described in our scriptures. And then when we contemplate and see how complex everything is, can we really be satisfied with an explanation which says that this has all occurred through random chance? Which is basically the essence of what scientists are explaining. That everything has just been created through collision of matter and things by chance, by almost trial and error, have come to what they are today. I don't find that satisfactory. Evolution also is equally unsatisfactory. I've been reading, I've been perusing this book called Nature's IQ. I don't know if anyone has taken a look at it. It's a very interesting book. It basically looks at the theory of evolution on a very practical level. It studies various animals in nature, in their natural habitat. So their language, their colour, their breeding, partnerships, many aspects of their daily activities. And it looks at how complex, how sophisticated animals are. Never mind humans and the complexities of our bodies and the way they function, our brains and the way they function. And the only explanation that can be offered is that this is through the process of natural selection. So survival of the fittest. If the way you function isn't the best way to function, isn't sufficient to function within your particular habitat, then eventually you'll die out. And there's natural mutations through species, and through these natural random mutations, which biologists describe, eventually you'll come to a situation where you are the fittest, and you can survive in your habitat, and you're better than those around you, and therefore you can progress and you can survive. Again, to have the complexities that we see around us To simply say that it's come about by random chance, by random mutations, by natural selection is again unsatisfactory. And even even Darwin, towards the end of his life, said that this is just a speculation. His theory of evolution is a speculation. So then it comes to what we believe through the Vedic literatures, through the Srimad Bhagavatam. I picked up Jananana Maharaj a couple of weeks ago from Luton Airport, and it's always very nice to pick up devotees, and especially senior devotees. He was reading from his Kindle. He was reading the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, the 13th chapter, the last chapter where Prabhupada wrote a commentary. And he was just reading through, and he was reading out loud, so I was driving, but I could also hear, which was very nice. And in this particular purport, Prabhupada was talking about two different processes of knowledge. The first is the Avaroha Pantha, and the second is the Aroha Pantha. So the Aroha Pantha is ascending knowledge. So we, using our mind and senses as humans, we'll try to understand the world around us. And this is basically the process that the scientists are using, Aroha Pantha. However, the Avaroha Pantha, Prabhupada describes, is descending knowledge. And he mentions a nice way of being able to remember which is which. The two are very similar, Aroha Pantha and Avaroha Pantha. But he says that Ava comes from avatar, and avatar means to descend. So Avaroha Pantha is descending knowledge. And Prabhupada is explaining that we should have faith in the Avaroha Pantha, in descending knowledge. And through this descending knowledge, we can actually understand the world around us. So Prabhupada is drawing some similarity between this chunk theory and the explosion in one sense. So Prabhupada is explaining that, yes, we also understand in the Srimad Bhagavatam, especially in the second and third cantos, it's described that there was a Mahatattva, a ball of matter or energy, which through the glance of the Lord, and the material, the three modes of material nature then began to work on this material energy, and then creation, that's when creation began. So the Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the primary creator, and then Lord Brahma from there began his secondary creation activities. So this is all described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And this we find to be much more of a satisfactory explanation of the world around us, because it explains how the complexities can actually come about. And so really what this comes down to is faith in Bhagavatam, faith in the Vedic literatures, faith in Prabhupada and what he's given us. This material scientist can be described, Prabhupada often explains, as frogs in the well. So a frog may be in a 9-foot well, maybe a couple of meters space, and he's observing his environment, and he's understanding that this is such, the well is so deep, and the well is so broad, so big, I'll drown if I jump into the water. So the frog is understanding that his own situation is so vast. But then if someone tells the frog that actually there's a vast Pacific Ocean out there, which is millions and millions of times bigger than your well, then the frog will think, okay, that's quite big. So he may think, oh, there's an 18-foot well, which, you know, maybe this ocean that's being described is 18 feet and maybe it's 4 meters wide. So its conception of life is very, very limited. So similarly, I think it's very important that we have to understand that our own conception of life, of the world, is also very limited, of the universe. We have very little perceptible understanding of the world around us. And actually what the Vedas give us, what the Srimad Bhagavatam give us, is descending knowledge which describes things in its entirety. I was discussing with one devotee, he's not here at the moment, last week I think, he showed me his notebook, and he was looking at the distances and the vastness of various planets. And he showed me the size of the moon and the size of the sun. I can't remember exactly how big It said the sun is. But basically the moon was twice as large as the sun. So the moon is twice as large as the sun, according to Srimad Bhagavatam. And in turn, the planet of Rahu is twice as large as the moon. But the planet Rahu is invisible to our eyes, although it's closer than the moon. And actually, the Bhagavatam describes that the moon is larger, but further away than the sun. So the sun is closer than the moon. Now obviously we understand through modern science and so on, that the moon is much, much smaller than the sun, and the moon is much closer to the sun. So then we wonder, who should we believe? Should we believe the scientists, or should we believe the Bhagavatam? At the end of the day, in one sense, it's not the most important question in the world, on one level. And on another level, why should we not believe Bhagavatam? Why should we not believe the Srimad Bhagavatam when it tells us anything? Because we have to some degree tried and tested the process of Srimad Bhagavatam, but not just us. Sages over millions and millions of years have tried and tested the teachings of the Vedas, the teachings of the Bhagavatam. And their tests have been proved to be correct time and time again. Why should we believe in a group of people who change their opinion every few months, every few years? So at the end of the day, I suppose it's coming to 8:30, my proposition is that we should believe in Bhagavatam as opposed to the scientists, because we have absolute knowledge. We have knowledge which doesn't change, doesn't adapt to our surroundings, doesn't adjust to the latest new scientific observation or experiment. It's actually knowledge which has been tried and tested, which has remained sturdy, and which has remained the same for time immemorial. Thank you very much. I don't think we have time for questions, although I'm sure what I've said would probably elicit some discussion, if not a lot. But thank you very much. Thank Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.